Paul on the second missionary journey, Phrygia, Asia Minor, Laconia, Mysia, that area. And he wanted to preach in that area. But as we talked about from Acts chapter 16 last time, God said no. That's going to be especially interesting as we get into some information about Lydia a little bit later. But let's start with Acts chapter 16, looking at verses 10 and 11, and then we'll move on from there. We started these verses last week, but didn't have a chance to complete them. And when he had seen the vision, straightway we sought to go forth into Macedonia. You can see that in the map, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel unto them. Setting sail, therefore, from Troas, we made a straight course to Samothrace, and the day following to Neapolis. If you're going to get from Troas to Macedonia, you can see Macedonia is going to be all the way over there on the left. And you can see Troas, as you look at the orange on the map, that's at the upper and furthermost tip. If you're going to get from Troas to Macedonia, how do you think you're going to have to go? Yeah, you're going to have to go by boat. This is not something that you can walk. It's not going to be a land trip. That was beneficial, too, because just like now, well, maybe not just like now, but depending on circumstances, in the ancient world, if you were going to travel by foot or land or sea, water, which likely was going to be quicker?
Boat.
By boat, you're probably going to be able to make possibly 100 or so miles a day. On a good day, and if you're doing a land trip, in that day and time, it's probably going to be 30 miles per day. It might not seem too significant to us, but if you start looking at what was taking place in Acts chapter 16, you have to step back a little bit and say, wow, and they probably talked about this when they're on the ship. If you're going to go to Troas and head over as far as where these guys were going, they want to get a ship in the harbor there at Troas, and head over to the port of Neapolis. That was a trip which was not all that common. If you wanted to, for example, get a flight from here to Chicago, or you wanted to get a flight from here to Dallas, Fort Worth, or here to New York, call up the airline and they probably say, well, which flight do you want? We've got multiple flights every day of the week and perhaps multiple times for each day of the week. But you want to go to some small out-of-the-way airport, what might you find?
Once
a week, or maybe in some parts of Alaska, it might be once a month. We just do not normally go there, and that could be true by ship. And that was true for this. This was something that was not very common because of where the port of Neapolis was. And you find, even though that was not that common, there's this ship that just happens to be heading there. It just happens to be ready. It just happens to have enough room or be willing to take passengers. Everything falls into place for these guys to end up on this ship and go where they needed to go. That's an example of God's providence. That's not called providence, but when we think about providence as far as someone says, well, all the stars lined up for me. That may be how someone thinks about that in the secular realm. From a spiritual standpoint, we're talking about the providence of God. This ship had a straight course or a good wind. Verse 11 tells us that it took one day to get over to Samothrace. They arrived at Neapolis on the next day, and the voyage from Troas to Neapolis, about 150 miles. Later, this is over in Acts chapter 20 and verse 6, this course is reversed, and it took 5 days because of bad weather. You sometimes see that with boats today. You're out, and if everything is good, I can remember younger years sometimes being out in some very small boats. If you don't have much as far as waves, you maybe don't want to go full throttle and beat up the boat, but you can really crank things up, and you can be moving at a pretty good pace. But you get out there, and you get some bad weather, and you've got some high waves, and you decide that you're going to go almost full throttle. What's going to happen to you? Well, best case scenario, you're probably going to be wet. Worst case scenario, you might overturn the boat. You just have to be careful. And sometimes, especially with a sailboat, I've always wanted to sail but never had the opportunity. But if you're sailing and the wind's not cooperating or you're relying on a sail, that's also certainly going to inhibit your progress. Stan or Ray, I'm not sure which one last week, pointed out the pronoun we. That changes in Acts chapter 16. That is exactly right. That's a subtle change, but Luke introduces the we, and that is pointing us to the fact that he's now joining the evangelistic effort of Paul, Silas, and others. You have really three we sections in the book of Acts. This section, Acts 16, verses 10 to 17. The second section is going to be found in Acts chapter 20. That'll be Acts chapter 20, verses 5 through 15. Then you have to go all the way to Acts chapter 27. Acts 27, verse 1 through Acts chapter 28 and verse 16. As you look through the book of Acts, you're going to see in the next chapter, Acts chapter 17 and verse 1, Luke switches to they. That would suggest that he was with the team as they were in Philippi. He stays with the people in Philippi because the congregation has started there while the others move on to some other places. As you look at commentators or other people, you may have some notes in your Bible. There are some people who think that Luke was a resident of Philippi. I don't know that there's any real evidence for that. Others have suggested that because there was a medical school in Philippi and Luke was a doctor, they say, well, he was a resident of Philippi and that's where he got his medical training. That's possible. Once again, I'm not sure that we have a lot of evidence for that. It's even been proposed by some that this man that Paul saw, Acts 16 and verse 9, was Luke. There is no evidence of that. You also find that because Luke spoke well of Philippi, and he did, you see that in the first part of verse 12, that's set forth as evidence for all the things that I just mentioned. But once again, that seems pretty lightweight or pretty flimsy. Philippi, let's talk about that place for just a minute. It was a Roman colony. We're going to see that in the next verse, Acts 16 and verse 12. And it was something like Rome away from Rome. It was a very unique place. Rome, as you look at how it was organized and what it did, it took some of its citizens and it commanded its citizens to live over here. Now that might seem odd for us to say to a bunch of people, we are going to have you live over here. But that can sometimes be a good thing. It's sort of the, Mr. Trump, let's make a deal. You live over here, and what am I going to offer you? If you will pick up everything, as I'm telling you to do, and you go over here, what am I going to give you?
Whatever you want.
Some really good stuff. It may not be quite that extensive, but I'm going to give you a very fine deal. And that's what Rome did. You would find this was really sort of an outpost on foreign soil. We've done that with America, haven't we? We take people and put them where in the world? We're going to establish a fort, a garrison, or base where? Japan? Or the Philippines? Or South Korea? We do that. We tell people, we want you to be over there. We're going to, and we're going to give you some benefits if you do that. Rome did that, and one of the places where that was done was Philippi. A lot of retired military lived in this and similar communities. And one of the benefits was, we're not going to have you pay any taxes. But wouldn't that be nice? We're going to put you over there, but you are in a tax-free state. You think about the taxes that we pay. Property taxes, car tax, gas tax, income tax. There are a bunch of them. But these people were able to live tax-free. Also, they had the same rights as cities on Italian soil. Samothrace is another place that we have here mentioned. That as you look at the map, it was an island, a small island in the Aegean Sea. It was about 30 square miles, so I don't remember what Neriah told us the Cayman Islands had as far as miles, but I'm thinking that they're in that same general ballpark, so fairly small place. It's really a stepping stone as far as this island on Paul's voyage from Troas in Asia Minor to Europe. One of the interesting things about that was, if you were to go to that place today, I understand that the mountain that they have, it's about 5,000 feet tall. It was a good way for the sailors to gauge where to go. That's assuming that you have good weather. It's like today, if you need to make your way out of the woods and there is a tall hill or there's a tall mountain or there's something way off in the distance, you're able to, even though you've got some trees, you're able to say, we can navigate because as long as we look at that distant point, we know we're headed in the right direction. That was true for these people as they were trying to reach this area by sea. Another thing that was interesting about this island is that it was considered to be a sacred place. They had a cult, and that would be an offbeat religious group. It was known as, and I'm going to give you my pronunciation of the name. I could be incorrect about it, but I believe it was the Cabiri. I'm going to give you a couple quotes here. That's spelled C-A-B-I-R-I. I believe the C is pronounced as a K, or Cabiri maybe. Quote says, it offered its initiates, the people who wanted to be part of it, protection, moral improvement, and the promise of immortality. I'm going to give you that again and then ask a question. There's this secretive group, this cult, that offers people protection, moral improvement, and the promise of immortality. Does that ring any bells for anybody? Well, there would be that as far as some of the modern religious cults. You certainly can see parallels there. Anything else? One more time. Protection, moral improvement, and the promise of immortality.
We don't couch it in those terms, but that's Christianity.
Well, that's true too. I still didn't get the answer I want. How about the Masonic Lodge? Well, they are somewhat secretive. Stan and I recently went to a Masonic funeral, and they do talk about immortality. You know, with the white apron, you're going to head off and you're going to be cared for by God. There is that element. There is also the element of moral improvement. If you talk to a Mason, they are about being moral people. And then there's also that element of protection. The fellow that died, and Stan and I went to his funeral service. I asked him, he used to cut my hair, and I asked him, I said, I've always been told that if you're a Mason, up to the crime of murder, and maybe including the crime of murder, if you're guilty and you're a good Mason in good standing with the lodge, they can get you off one time. And he kind of looked at me and he said, yeah, he said, even on the murder charge. Now, that was his assessment. He had gone all the way through the ranks. What I found especially interesting, though, beyond all that, was this particular group is actually referenced in Masonic writings. Yes, the Cabaret. Now, the Masonic writings talk about a lot of stuff, including some Bible stuff, but included in their literature. So it sounds a lot like the lodge. It was somewhat welcoming to visitors. The Masonic Lodge, to a certain degree, does that today. One source says he wondered if Paul and Silas peeked in. I wonder. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at verses 12 and 13? Okay. We're in Acts chapter 16, if you've just joined us, looking out at verse 12. And from thence to Philippi, which is a city of Macedonia, the first of the district, a Roman colony. And we were in this city tarrying certain days. And on the Sabbath day, we went forth without or outside the gate by riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer. And we sat down and spake to the women that were come together. The evangelists, they get to the area of Neapolis. They travel about 10 miles. That would have been on a paved road. It may be hard for us to believe, but 2,000 years ago, they had paved roads. The Romans had paved roads. That was one of the things that helped promote the gospel. You don't need a paved road to move, but certainly that's going to be conducive for a lot of things. Philippi is described as the first city of the district, as well as a Roman colony. First has been understood in a variety of ways. I think it probably means leading, chief. And part of the reason for that would be what I mentioned a few minutes ago. We're going to put you over here, but if we do that, what are we going to do? We're going to give you special privileges, one of which would be no taxation. Stan?
Well, you mentioned it, the fact that the road that they traveled on was a paved road, but it was a part of a much bigger, what we would almost call an interstate today, not physically, but in its locale and its layout, which went all the way across the peninsula of Greece there,
yes,
to a convenient seaport on the Aegean Sea. So
yes,
it was away from Italy, but it was not that difficult, really. It took a little time, but it was not a bad trip.
No. I mean, this was sort of the premium path, so to speak. It was not just a few stones cobbled together. Along with that, you see the word colony there. That's a reminder of Rome's influence. This really was a place where it looked like a home away from home. You've got a garrison there. People were following Roman customs, Roman laws, and it would be like stepping away from Rome, and yet you're still sort of in a place where things look so familiar. The city, as far as Philippi, was considered to be the most important one in that particular part of Macedonia. Paul seems to have recognized that he tarried there for certain days. We don't know exactly how long that was, but as you look at verses 13 and 16, if you compare them, I think you have to say they were at least there for two Sabbaths, so at least 2 weeks thereabouts. Verse 13 says, "And on the Sabbath day we went forth." It sounds like they've been waiting for a little while. And then as you go down to verse 16, "And it came to pass as we were going to the place of prayer that a certain maid having a divination also at the time of the Sabbath day." So we think at least a couple weeks were spent there. Philippi was named after Philip. That would have been the father of Alexander the Great. It was located, if you go back and try to do some looking at it, located on a hill with woods to the north, marsh to the south, as far as the sea, gorges on the east, fertile plain on the west. So if you got to this area, a lot of interesting things as far as the topography of the land. One source said the city proper consisted of 167 acres and some 5 to 10,000 residents. Now that's not, depending on where you've grown up, a lot of people, 5 to 10,000 people. But it was, in God's estimation, a good place to begin the gospel. It was also noted how this was a center more of agriculture than of commerce. Lydia may have been there because this was the most prosperous city in the district. If you're a business owner, you want to go where the people have money. Now, you might be, when Teresa and I were down south, down there in the area of Alabama and Mississippi, we had a chance to go down and see a place where people like Tom Selleck and Oprah had some houses. There was a little island. You had a road out to the island and so forth, and I mean, you didn't have to have a lot of people out there on the island to make a lot of money. If you're dealing with houses that are perhaps $5 or $8 million apiece, those add up. But as you look at Philippi, it was a very, as they say, prosperous town. The city had gold mines, which had produced gems. And there had been a time prior to this that Philippi had been a gold rush town. When I think about gold rushes, I'm thinking about really our country back in the 1800s and so forth, but there have been other gold rushes in the world, and Philippi actually had that in some of its history. A lot of people assume that Lydia was a prosperous woman. I don't think she was poor. She may not have been as wealthy as some people consider, but she seems to have been doing at least reasonably well. That's important for what reason?
She's a woman.
Well, there is that. Where's she from? Okay, which was where? Let's look at our map. Can the map help us? Okay. And in that area of Macedonia, right? What do we know about the... Oh, I'm sorry. I got off base there. What was I... It is. It is in Asia. I wanted to make my point. Back in Second Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. What do we remember about the people of Macedonia? I worded my point in the wrong way. She's from Asia Minor. That is correct. She's over in the area of Macedonia now. What do we know about Christians from the area of Macedonia? Anybody remember? Were they wealthy? 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and 2, or are they poor?
Poor.
And how poor?
Very poor?
They were very poor. So Lydia is in an area where the converts that are finally forthcoming from Macedonia, the people are really struggling. Let's see what else I want to tell you. One source observed how Paul and his friends did not plunge immediately into evangelizing the city, even though they knew God had called them there. No doubt they needed to rest and pray and make their plans together. It's not enough to know where God wants us to work. We must also know when and how he wants us to work. That, to me, is a good point. Sometimes it's tempting just to rush into something and do it, but it is not always necessarily the best course. Stan?
Well, she was a seller of purple. We know that purple was something that was valued. But I don't know whether someone who was a middleman made good money from that.
That's the thing that you have to consider, and that's sort of what I was driving at. Depending on where she was in the food chain, I think we have to say, especially as a woman, she's doing reasonably well. But the idea that she would have been quote-unquote rich in that day and time that might go beyond what we have as far as evidence. But we'll say more about the purple in just a minute. Anybody else want to add or ask something before we make a few more points? Bonnie?
Before Stan made that comment, what you said, could you repeat that?
Sure. The area of Macedonia over on the left part of the map. That's where Lydia is. She's not from there. She's from the area of Asia Minor on the right side of the map. But on the left side of the map, they're in the area of Macedonia. As we look elsewhere, the Corinthian letter, 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and 2, we read about people who became Christians. They were from that area, and Paul said they were extremely poor. So here's Lydia. She's apparently doing reasonably well, maybe extremely well, but many other Christians are people who became Christians in that area. They were financially destitute.
Well, there was this little saying that you said. I remembered all that, but I forget what it was now.
Let's go back to that. Yes, from Wiersbe, I think. It's not enough to know where God wants us to work. He also wants us to pay attention to when and how. Where, when, and how were the three key words there. So sorry about giving you all that information when you just wanted the small amount. All right. If... Yes.
So maybe she was, even though she was in the area of Macedonia, maybe she was a little bit at least in the middle of what we would consider the upper middle class. Maybe.
Yeah. I'd say that's reasonable.
She had enough money to travel.
Yes, yeah. She did. So, and if you're somebody who is in that middleman category where you have some authority and whatnot, you're probably going to be doing okay. Definitely not going to be in the chow line hunting for food. Now, where's she at?
Down by a river.
Out by a river. If you are doing things associated with Judaism, where would you expect to be on the Sabbath day?
In the synagogue.
In the synagogue. But she's not in the synagogue. The question then becomes, why?
Well, she worshiped God.
She did. But why is she not in the synagogue on the Sabbath? I think one of the questions that you have to ask is, did they have a synagogue? If you've only got roughly 5,000 to 10,000 people, your population is not that big to begin with. I think that's probably logical. For the Jews, they generally looked at a synagogue as needing 10 men. You have fewer than that, you can still meet, you can still assemble, but that's not going to be what happened here. So even though that's not specifically said, I believe that's probably what was taking place. Either no Jewish men or too few to have a synagogue. You also have the order. Ray asked about this last week from Acts chapter 18 and verse 2. There was that order from Claudius for all Jews to leave Rome. We don't know that that extended to this area because this was not quote-unquote Rome per se. As I said, it was sort of that Rome away from Rome. They had all the privileges, all the rights of Rome. But if that edict from Claudius that we read about a little later also extended to this area, then that also could have helped depopulate the Jews. This small of a community, maybe that order, being people who've lived there for a long time, do you think you would know where this group worshipped? Somebody comes into town and says, hey, are there some Jews in town worshiping God? Be like going to a town today of 10,000 people, and you say, well, anybody do mechanical work in town? Well, yeah, three houses down on the left, he's got the green shutters, that's him. Everybody knows he does that. It would not have been very hard to find out where these women were or where the Jews were. And I think, too, they probably had a pretty good idea as far as where to look. If you're going to go to town and there's no synagogue, well, you're probably going to find some Jews if you're Paul.
Well, these were down by the river.
Okay. Yeah. Would you have looked by the river? Would that have seemed to be a logical place to look?
I would think so, because if somebody was going to obey the gospel, then there was the water to baptize them.
You're half right. Let's take the first half of your answer. It would have made sense for the Jews to be by the river for what reason? There you go. That's the other half of that. You've got all those ritual washings, don't you? You don't want to have to be carrying water from somewhere. If you've got a river, well, There's your water source. Great. You can go and do all the things that you need to do. It would have made perfect sense. Anytime you're looking for the Jews, no synagogue, find out where the local river is. In this case, it would have been about a mile from the city. Go down there. Paul has, going back to the vision that he has, remember Acts chapter 16 and verse 9, what's the vision? There's this person sitting or standing? Standing and saying what?
We need help.
We need help. Well, Paul gets to the right area, and guess what he finds? Where are the men? Well, there are no men. Who do you find?
Women.
Some women in the synagogue down by the river. I don't know if Paul was disappointed or not, but I'll tell you, there'd be some preachers who'd be disappointed in that today. God, you brought me all the way over here to talk to some women, and they don't even have a synagogue to worship. What are you doing? You think people sometimes can reason like that when it comes to prayer today? God, what are you doing? Well, he was doing something. Let's continue to read. Oh, Don, I'm sorry.
Say that there were no men there, right? It doesn't say that there were no men there.
No.
Because it says it in prayer, and I'm sure usually the men, the Jewish men, will lead the prayer, right?
Well, unless there are none, then you're going to have an all-female gathering.
Are you sure it's all-female?
I can't prove that conclusively. There is no mention of a male, but that's not going to, as I said, let you conclude with absolute certainty that there were no males.
There wasn't enough to establish a synagogue though, correct? You said there began to establish.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Down the end of 13 is as far as I can go. They spake unto the women that were come together.
In 13, it said, on the Sabbath went out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made, and sat down and spoke to women. We have to assume that they knew it was all women down there by the riverside. They probably didn't know it was all women or men or mixed.
When they were headed down there? I would think that's true. You don't know who's going to be there, but when you get there and you do the speaking, that was my point, that Paul, assuming that there were no men there that were willing to listen, or no men there at all, it's God, is this really the group of people that I've come to speak to? I had people over there that I could have preached the gospel to. Now, with this trip, it's some women down by the riverside.
No, had Paul been met to the women because Lydia was there? Pretty influential woman.
We're going to develop that a little bit more, maybe not to the point that you're asking about right now, and if we don't develop that far, let's come back to it. Anybody else?
But once, if it was all women in the group, once Paul and Silas got there, they would have had to been silent, right?
Silent in what sense? I mean, you
are... They couldn't be preaching.
Well, yes.
Say there was a woman preaching, but once they got there, then they would have had
to then. Sure. If she understands, and we would assume that from the teaching, the next Sunday comes, they meet together, the women would not have been doing the teaching with Paul and his company in the assembly. Okay, let's pick up with verse 14. And a certain woman named Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, and that worshiped God, heard us, whose heart the Lord opened to give heed unto the things which were spoken by Paul. One of the ladies, as we've already noted, that was at the riverbank was Lydia. She was a businesswoman. The text says she was a seller of purple. Like now, people sometimes pay attention to a person's occupation. Oh, he's a dry cleaner. Oh, he's a maintenance man. Oh, she's a nurse. Oh, this one is a teacher and so forth. As you look at some of the ancient tombstones, I don't know that you see this too often today, but in ancient grave markers, the professions of people were often inscribed on those tombstones. This man was a tool and die maker. This fellow was the one who crafted caskets or whatever it might be. So sort of an interesting piece of history. We do know, because of what Luke said, that she was from the city of Thyatira. Where else do we read about Thyatira later in the New Testament? Anybody remember? Yeah, over there in the book of Revelation, they got one of John's letters, Revelation chapter 2, verses 18 through 29. The limited details that we have about Lydia suggest that she was a business agent for maybe an upscale textile service or company or industry in Thyatira versus owning her own business. I don't think, and that kind of goes back to what Stan was saying, I think she's in that middleman category versus having her own shop. You find some very practical lessons from Lydia. First of all, she is on this trip. She's a businesswoman. Nothing, I think, well, maybe you could deduce that it was a pleasure trip, but if it was a business trip, did she forget about God? If it was a pleasure trip, did she forget about God? No. She worshiped God. She seems to have understood that people have spiritual responsibilities, even though they may be involved with business activities or they're involved with pleasurable activities. She, if she were on business, could have said or could not have said, well, today's a day where I can make some money. She could have said that. I'm not going to worship God today. I'm going to engage in my business. But she was mindful of the Sabbath. She did not let that business separate her from her spiritual commitment. You, if we're correct in saying that there were no Jewish synagogues in the area, you do not have this woman reasoning like some people today would reason. There are individuals who go to a certain place, maybe because of vacation, Steve. If you're raising a hand, I'll get you in a second. There are people sometimes who go to a certain place and they say, well, there's no place to worship today, but it's Sunday. What are we going to do? We're just going to skip it. Well, some would say we're going to have our own, but would there not be some people who say we're going to skip it? If there's no place to assemble with God's people, we're free. That wasn't her attitude. This is a good model for us. Steve?
Maybe I'm getting too far ahead. I don't know. But the Sabbath, they would still be under the old law, considering the old law, correct?
Okay, let's... Okay. I'm not following, I don't think, the question right now.
Well, the old law on the Sabbath, you weren't supposed to work, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, if she was truly trying to follow the old law, she is doing what's right.
Right.
Yeah, in her estimation, in her understanding.
So Paul was meeting them at where they were at. They were still
correct
in the old meeting on the Sabbath.
Yes, and that's another great lesson. He picks up with them where they were. You're someone who worships God. You're trying to honor him on this day. You've not put your business above God. You've got a good heart. I have a message for you that is tied into what you're doing. In fact, it helps you move beyond what you're doing into the new and better system that was created by Jesus. It was a perfect opportunity, and by her actions, she showed that she was a really good candidate for the gospel. So,
and it doesn't say, like when they established new congregations, new churches, it doesn't say, but is it for us to assume that then they met on the first day instead of meeting on the Sabbath?
After Lydia was converted?
After conversions were made.
Okay.
Is it safe to assume that they were taught to meet on the first day of the week?
I would say that that had to be part of the teaching or part of the gospel, because that's what you find in places like Acts chapter 20.
Right.
First
that's
day comes.
What you read about that.
Yes. If people still wanted to meet on Saturday, I would imagine that Paul, just like he goes into the Jewish synagogue at various times, and he was not the only one, they're perfectly willing to meet with the Jews, and they're willing to sit through the service, whatever that involved, the prayers, the scripture readings, and so forth. And then when there was an opportunity to teach or talk to people, that really became a Bible study opportunity for them. But Sunday was that prescribed and followed day of worship. Going back to some other things as far as what Lydia was doing, when you look at the map, we've got, as we said, Macedonia on the left side of the map. We've got Asia Minor on the right side of the map. Lydia is about 300 miles away from the place where she would have normally called home. And remember, as you look at that right side of the map, over there in the area of Asia Minor where Paul had been, what had God said about preaching?
No.
Don't preach here right now. You go about way over here, about 300 miles, and we're going to give you some work here. Had he preached here on the right side of the map, Asia Minor, at least as things are described, who wouldn't have heard? Lydia. Very interesting that God gets him over to where Lydia is, and she becomes really the first convert or among the first converts in Philippi. When we think about Lydia, going back to a point that I started just a minute ago and didn't have a chance to fully develop it, when we're out and about We take vacation or we're out for a business trip. I know especially with business trips, sometimes that can interfere with what we can do. There may be some obligations, meetings and so forth. But when we're away from home, we should do our best to do what we would normally do at home. And that means if we can assemble when we're away, assemble. You have some other things. I had somebody talk to me about this the other day. They say sometimes, you know, when it comes to first day of the week and contributions, people sometimes think, well, we're going to be away for 2 weeks and we'll just use the extra money for vacation. That's probably not the best biblical choice. If you don't give what you normally would before you leave, and that's an option, give it after you come back. Don't short God because you're going on vacation or a business trip. If you prosper less during that time, then okay. That contribution, biblically speaking, so should certainly reflect that. But the idea that some have, well, we're just going to somehow be free during that time, Lydia didn't do that, and that, as I said, is a good example for us. Anything that you want to add or ask before I throw in one other quick point? You find sometimes some people say that God hates women or Paul hated women. If you heard that and you're thinking about Acts chapter 16, what would you say? That is not true. God certainly didn't hate her. When you look at what happened with Paul, God said, you can't preach over here. I'm going to send you over. And one of the people you're going to preach to is this woman down by a riverbank where there's presumably no synagogue. No. And Paul certainly didn't go down there and say, oh, man, a bunch of women. I want the men. I'm not going to teach you people. No. You can't get that from here or anywhere else in Scripture. Let's go back and talk about Lydia's trade for just a little bit. That's noteworthy. When we talk about colors today, Teresa and I go through this sometimes. I don't know, maybe one of us has a color problem, and I don't think it's me, but anyway. She's not in here, so I can say that. People sometimes will say, well, that's red. Somebody says, well, no, that's a different color. Or that's green. No, that's a different color. In ancient times, people, when they talked about the color purple, that included various shades of crimson and red. Purple was, in those various colors, very popular. As you look at Sardis, there were some purple couch covers that were very popular in Sardis. Also, I'm going to give you this note. As you look at the denarii, in Matthew 20, verse 2, that word is actually used, and I'm going to use passages which use that word, at least in the Greek, may not be in the English, but a denarii was a day's wage, Matthew chapter 20 and verse 2. There were some people, some wealthy people, who paid more than 1,000 denarii. So 1,000 days' wages, and this is what they got, a pound of the finest Tyrian wool doubly stained. Roughly 3 years' pay for a pound of wool that was stained with this purplish color. Can you imagine that? Just a pound of wool. 3 years' pay. And if you take off the weekends, it would have been more than that. The people of Thyatira, where Lydia was from, we believe that they used an imitation purple there, something that's still known as Turkey red, and they got that. I'm going to give you this information. This is some technical stuff, but it's still easy to understand. This was from the root of the local madder plant rather than the Murex shellfish. The purple from the shellfish, which apparently isn't what Lydia traded in, was extremely expensive and very, very hard to get. It said that the dye from the shellfish could only be accessed when the shellfish were alive. After the workers collected the shellfish, they used iron tools to break them up. They forced out a purple liquid that dried rapidly unless honey was mixed with it. Some of the murex that had to be crushed were over a foot wide, and it said that you needed 8,000 of them to get a drop of dye. Now, can you imagine trying to crush 8,000 of these things, some being over a foot long, and after all that work, if you don't mess it up, you remember you've got to deal with it quickly, mix it with the honey, you get a single drop of dye. You talk about expensive. And this stuff was costly. So today, when you think, oh boy, the red one is more than the blue one, it's $5 more. It is cheap. All right, some of the other things. I want to tell you, as far as that manufacturing process, it was not a very pleasant experience. As we travel perhaps in this area and you bypass a plant, you think, boy, that one stinks. I'm sure glad I don't work here. I'm sure glad I don't work there. The work was stigmatized as, I'm giving you a quote, the work was stigmatized as a foul-smelling and dirty process which involved animal urine. So if you ever had a job that you didn't like, at least you didn't have to handle animal urine. But if you were going to do some of the dyeing, that was part of that. Dye houses usually were restricted to remote zones outside the city, and there's nothing to indicate that Lydia was involved in the dyeing process or that she had her own business. So this was sort of complex, and as you look at what she was doing, I do think that she probably was sort of the middleman person. Okay, saying that she worshiped God was a nice way to say that a Gentile was interested and tried to follow the tenets of Judaism. As you think about her, her heart reminds you a lot of the eunuch back in Acts chapter 8. Also, what we find with Cornelius back in Acts chapter 10, Acts chapter 11. The book has multiple accounts of people who were interested in God, people who wanted to do what was right, but they weren't quite on the right path. God ensured that someone who was able to present the gospel to them was able to hook up with them, give them the information, and then because they got what was right, they followed it, and then were on the right path. Let's take a look at a couple of the things that we're not going to be able to fully develop. The middle of verse 14 says she heard what Paul and Silas had to say. Now that verb, which is translated heard, is used in some other texts. I'm going to run these off quickly for you. Jesus says, give heed. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1, when you give your alms or when you do your good deeds. That's the same word. You pay attention to how you're giving. You may remember in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15, Jesus said, beware of false prophets. That's the same word. Take heed, pay attention to the people who may be out to give you false information. Back in Acts chapter 8 and verse 6, people gave heed to the preaching that was done by Philip. That is, they listened, they wanted to know, they were seeking to understand. Many gave heed to Simon the sorcerer, same word, Acts chapter 8 and verse 10. They were listening carefully or closely to what he had to say. Elders, Acts 20 and verse 28, are told to take heed to the flock. Make sure that nothing gets out of order. Pay attention. Same thing in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 4. Some give heed to fables and endless genealogies. Some give heed to much wine, 1 Timothy 3:8. Others give heed to seducing spirits, 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1. Lydia gave heed to the gospel. She was willing to listen to it. The word heed is followed what word? Yeah. All right, and I think you also have the word heart. That heart is the part of our ability which allows us to reason, Matthew 9 and verse 4. It is our heart which can understand, Matthew 13 and verse 15. It is the heart which can perceive, John 12 and verse 4, or 40 rather, John 12, 40, at least in the ASV. It's the heart that believes, Romans 10 and verse 10. And it's that heart where the word is sown, Matthew 13 and verse 19. Some hearts, though, are closed, they're hardened, they're darkened, and that is a spiritual problem. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, or 3 and verse 15.